I'm Laura Flynn, and this is Making Contact.
We had an ultra-segregationist by the name of Leander Perez, who was a part of the National White Citizen Council for Alabama, Mississippi, and all those states to prevent people from registering to vote. But Mr. Victor Ragus was one of the civil rights leaders, and he started the first march for the right to vote in Black comparison in 1941. So people be hearing about Selma, Alabama, and all other places in the country. My exhibit here in this building is so that future generation understand that when you think of Dr. Martin Luther King and all these people, you have people in Black comparison who are doing this work, you know, since the early 40s.
Reverend Tyrone Edwards' exhibit, Freedom Fighters for the Right to Vote, honors the struggle for civil rights in Plaquemines Parish, Louisiana. Communities throughout the South, just like this one, are filled with local heroes who never made it to the history books, but played an influential role in shaping civil rights legislation. On this edition of Making Contact, we'll hear how people are trying to preserve these legacies, and how 50 years after the Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act, shifting policies are threatening some of those hard-fought gains towards equality. First, we head to Monroe, Georgia, where the last mass lynching in the U.S. took place back in 1946. The case remains open, but one group stages an annual reenactment in hopes of solving it and drawing attention to the political repression at the time. Anna Simonton's father plays a Klansman in the reenactment. She takes us to the scene.
They say you've been putting your hands on my woman. The hell you got to say about that, Hester?
I ain't gonna tell you again. Get off my property before I kick you off.
It was in 1946 in the small town of Monroe, Georgia, on a hot July afternoon, when Roger Malcolm, a Black man, accused his white employer, Barnett Hester, of sleeping with his wife. Their argument turned physical, and Malcolm stabbed Hester, then fled. He turned himself over to local law enforcement later that day and was booked at the Walton County Jail. Roger Malcolm's wife, Dorothy Malcolm, sought help from Loy Harrison, a wealthy white farmer her relatives worked for. On July 25, 1946, Harrison drove Dorothy Malcolm, along with her brother and his wife, to Monroe, where they bailed out Roger Malcolm from jail.
Mr. Loy, I so appreciate this.
Yeah, we better go.
On the way to the farm, Harrison took a back road through cotton fields and groves of trees. When they arrived at the Moores Ford Bridge, vehicles blocked the road on the other side. Men emerged from them and advanced toward Harrison's car as he slowed down. They had laid in wait for Roger Malcolm, the Black man who had stabbed his white boss.
What's going on?
Some of the men pulled Roger Malcolm from the car and put a noose around his neck. They began to lead him down to a field when Dorothy Malcolm suddenly shouted the name of one of the members of the mob. Later, Loy Harrison would tell the FBI that this happened, but would insist he couldn't remember the name she shouted.
You know him?
Instead of lynching only Roger Malcolm, they would execute the three witnesses as well. It would be the last mass lynching in the United States.
Get them all out of the car!
Members of the mob tied up the two couples.
Ready! One! Two! Three! Fire!
No more!
And then they fired 60 bullets into their bodies.
I'm going home to live with my Lord God.
Georgia State Representative Tyrone Brooks leads an audience through each scene of this annual reenactment of the mass lynching. He's been instrumental in organizing the event over the past 10 years, and in that time, he's come to emphasize one aspect of this crime in particular.
The tragedy at the Moores Ford Bridge on July 25, 1946 was more than just the lynching of two African-American couples. It really was a way to instill fear in the African-American community and to keep us away from the voting booth.
Since 1891, Georgia, like a number of southern states, had a law preventing black people from voting in the Democratic primary. Cliff Kuhn, a history professor at Georgia State University, explains.
The Democratic primary being all white, where the argument was the Democratic Party is a private club and can exclude whomever it wants, you know, on the basis of the fact that it's a private club. The Democratic primary was the only election that really mattered, and African Americans were excluded.
But in 1944, a black preacher from Columbus, Georgia, filed a lawsuit challenging the all-white primary, and his case went all the way to the Supreme Court. On April 1, 1946, the court ruled that Georgia's whites-only Democratic primary was unconstitutional.
That paved the way for a dramatic voter registration drive among African Americans in the spring of 1946, where over 100,000 black Georgians registered to vote, far and away the more than in any other southern state.
It also paved the way for Eugene Talmadge, Georgia's three-time former governor and racist firebrand, to enter the gubernatorial race that year. In 1946, the conditions were ripe for Talmadge to do what he did best, capitalize on racist fear-mongering.
If elected your governor, I shall see that the traditions which were fought for by our grandparents are maintained and preserved. I shall see that the people of this state have a democratic white primary.
Every year, reenactors stage a Talmadge speech in between the fight scene and the jail scene. Talmadge won the primary. An FBI investigation later revealed that elections officials had purged thousands of ballots cast by black voters. In the run-up to the primaries, white people in towns across Georgia intimidated would-be black voters with cross burnings, mob gatherings, and pamphlets that threatened fatal retaliation. Professor Kuhn says the worst episode took place in Butler, Georgia.
The one black man who dares to vote in the primaries, a man named Maceo Snipes, World War II veteran, goes to the polls in his uniform, shot in the back when he leaves, is murdered. So we're talking a range of forms of violence and intimidation that the Talmadge folks in particular unleash leading up to the primary in July.
8 days after the murder of Maceo Snipes, Roger Malcolm would be lynched, along with Dorothy Malcolm and her brother and sister-in-law. Tyrone Brooks says the timing was no coincidence.
It was more about voting in 1946 than just an incident between Roger Malcolm and Barnett Hester. It was a whole climate of suppressing the vote. They were angry about the Supreme Court ruling. They were shocked that the Supreme Court would rule to strike down an all-white primary. But it happened.
Unlike so many lynchings before, the massacre at Moores Ford Bridge provoked a national outcry. It became the most massive lynching investigation in the nation's history. But after 6 months, during which FBI agents interviewed more than 2,000 people and came up with a list of 55 suspects, the case was left cold. No one was ever charged. Professor Kuhn says this is typical.
And time after time after time after time after time during the lynching era, the coroner's report would say, at the hands of persons unknown, when everybody knew who had done it.
In 2007, the Associated Press obtained FBI files showing that the agency investigated suspicions that Governor-elect Eugene Talmadge was in on the lynching. According to an unconfirmed witness, Talmadge met with the brother of the man Roger Malcolm had stabbed and offered immunity to anyone who, quote, took care of Malcolm. State Representative Tyrone Brooks.
I want people to understand that the struggle for voting rights didn't start in 1965. 20 years before Selma, that was a Monroe, that was a Butler, that was the Malcolms and Dorseys, that was the Maceo Snipes, and many others across the South.
In 1999, Georgia Governor Roy Barnes reopened the Georgia Bureau of Investigations, or GBI, probe into the lynching. The FBI followed suit, reopening its investigation in 2006. But so far, neither has led to charges being brought.
You know, the GBI and local and others have brought information time after time to the doorsteps of the local district attorney, the federal agencies, U.S. attorneys, And for whatever reason, they've decided we are not going to move on these suspects.
Brooks says the next step is to push for a congressional investigation. For now, civil rights groups continue to organize this reenactment as a refusal to forget and as a call for justice. From Monroe, Georgia, for Making Contact, I'm Anna Simonton.
A long time coming, and I know a change gonna come.
Public outcry did push President Harry Truman to create the President's Committee on Civil Rights, which included protections from lynchings. But brutality by angry white mobs would continue to be condoned and ignored by public officials for decades. Finally, in 1964, Congress had a noteworthy civil rights bill before it. But Southern Democrats, supporters of Jim Crow laws, were pushing a filibuster to kill the bill. It would take yet another violent incident to provoke federal action. This time, at a motel swimming pool in a touristy old port city in northeast Florida. Dina Weinstein has the story.
It's June 18, 1964 in St. Augustine, Florida. A group of rabbis are praying in the Monsimoto Lodge parking lot. Miami television station WCKT captures what happens next.
A group of 70 white and Negro demonstrators, including 15 rabbis from New Jersey, showed up at the motel to pray. They were met by the establishment's owner, James Broughton. While the rabbis were being arrested, Negro and white demonstrators clad in bathing suits jumped into the pool. Brock, frantic with rage, began dumping an acid cleaning agent into the water, apparently without harmful effect to the uninvited swimmers. Finally, an off-duty policeman leaped into the pool and began swinging at the demonstrators. The swimmers were dragged roughly from the water to waiting police vans.
The next day, images of the Monsimoto Lodge manager dumping acid into the pool splashed across the front pages of newspapers around the country. Congress broke out of its filibuster and passed the Civil Rights Act. The act forbids discrimination on the basis of race and gender in hotels, motels, restaurants, theaters, and all other public accommodations engaged in interstate commerce. J.T. Johnson was one of the swimmers in St. Augustine that day.
Well, it was a little worse than Alabama to me. I mean, we took more beatings here in St. Augustine than we did anywhere. Some of the things that happened here got the Civil Rights Bill passed.
Local activists had been protesting segregation in the historic city for over a year. They made the Monsimoto Lodge a primary target. Dr. Martin Luther King and Reverend Ralph Abernathy were denied service in the lodge's restaurant. The protest also led to the largest mass arrest of rabbis in American history. Rabbi Alan Setcher was one of these religious leaders who remembers the brutality.
The cop took a cattle prod, and as I remember it, the girl was in a skirt, not jeans. And the girl was in a skirt, and he took the prod, and he shoved it up her and turned it on. And then screamed, just a scream that I can hear still today. And he laughed. And he laughed, and then he kibitzed with his buddies.
Now, 50 years later, Setcher, five other rabbis, and Johnson came back to town to commemorate the events of 1964. This time, city officials welcomed them to lunch in the hotel on the same site they were arrested. The Monsimoto Lodge has since been replaced by a Hilton, but one landmark still remains.
This room is dedicated to Miss Peabody.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see right there where her hat is. And she wore that hat a lot when she went through the summer protest in March.
11th grade student Jarrell James walks a tour group through St. Augustine's new Civil Rights Museum. The museum is housed in the former dental office of local civil rights leader Dr. Robert Hayling. In 1963, Hayling protested a federally funded and segregated celebration marking the city's 400th anniversary. The Ku Klux Klan attacked him that year. In response, Hayling didn't hide. Instead, he increased his efforts to try and make St. Augustine the civil rights movement's next battleground. Teen docent Tamia Addison says it's a history she rarely hears about in school.
I thought it was a cool idea to come over and volunteer during the summer. So I was like, I know a little bit, not a lot, but.
Have you learned a lot?
Yeah, I'm constantly reading books and looking at different documents, constantly reminding myself by walking through the museum. And it's, yeah, I'm learning a lot.
J.T. Johnson, who was swimming in the pool back in 1964 when acid was thrown in the water, says memorials and museums are not enough to mend our societal problems.
They exist now. I mean, this not only in Florida, but in other states too. This country has to first get rid of racism before they can deal with the issues before them.
Even as a Civil Rights Act passed, St. Augustine's leadership resisted integration. Currently, there are no black elected officials. Locals see the 50th anniversary as a public acknowledgement of the accomplishments of the activists of 1964. But many in this town continue to struggle. Among the black residents in St. Augustine, more than a third live below the poverty line. For Making Contact, I'm Dina Weinstein in St. Augustine, Florida.
That we shall overcome someday.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Because of generous support from listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the US, Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to donate, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact.
My name is August T. Thinson. In 1955, I tried to become a registered voter because I had gone to the service. So when I came out of the service, I thought I should register, you understand? But since it made for me to go to the service and fight for a flag when I didn't have the right to vote, so I started down there at Blackman Parish Courthouse, and I had to take a written test. I passed the test. But the registered voter kept telling me I didn't make it every day I went there. And I went there for a whole solid year. And every day I went there, she tell me, you didn't make it. And they tell me, come back the next day. I did that for a year. And finally, I think it was in 1956 or something like that, or 57, I became a registered voter. You were called names, and after we started it, then we had, like, I think it was three older men that joined us to try to become registered voter, you understand? And when we went there, and they had a preacher that was with us, his name was Reverend Hardy, and every time he came in there, the registered voter was there, oh, here comes the big black, you understand? And we couldn't argue, because the preacher would tell us, leave her alone, which we did. Well, when we took her to court, her name was Ethel Fox. That was the registered voter. And when they took her to court, we had to go to court with her. And when the judge told her to get up there and tell me the Constitution of the United States, she bust out crying. But we had to repeat the Constitution of the United States to her before we become registered voter. And I tell you, I did some bad things because I was young at the time. And they told us, when we go back home, don't tell her nothing, leave her alone. But I got on the phone and I called her. I said, you sure made a fool out yourself. You made us recite the Constitution of the United States and you couldn't do it. And I hanged up on her.
Stories like August Hinson's were common, and while the Civil Rights Act of 1964 did ban unequal application of voter registration requirements, it still wasn't enough. Joining us to talk about the struggle to protect basic voting rights for all Americans is Gary May. He's a professor of history at the University of Delaware and the author of Bending Toward Justice, The Voting Rights Act and the Transformation of American Democracy. He starts us off in Selma, Alabama, where the conditions of racial intolerance would set the stage for the Voting Rights Act.
Selma was the county seat of Dallas County, and about 57% of the population were African American, but only 1% were registered to vote. Bernard Lafayette, in early 1963, he went to Selma, Alabama, to create a voting rights movement. He found there, already in existence, a voting rights movement that had been alive for 25 years. It was headed by Sam and Amelia Boynton, and they had been working for voter registration but had not made much progress. By that time, Sam Boynton was in a nursing home. Lafayette went to visit him, and the first thing Boynton would ask would be, "Have you registered yet?" A voteless people, he said, is a hopeless people. And so Lafayette attempted to bolster the movement that was already in existence. And he was able to create workshops where African Americans were prepared to go down to the courthouse where the registrar's office was open. African Americans who showed up at the registrar's office often found it closed. The registrars, who of course were all white, they would come to work late and they would leave early. If African-American applicant was lucky enough and all three registrars, which were required to be there, were there, they had to take two tests. One was an oral test. Then there was a written test. Among the questions, they'd have to interpret a clause of the Alabama State Constitution. Now, white applicants who took a similar test, the clause they had to interpret contained only 8 words. African Americans, however, had to interpret a clause that contained 260 words.
And then can you also talk about Freedom Day and how that became sort of a turning point in the movement to gain voting rights?
That particular day, Freedom Day, was in October of 1963. Several hundred African Americans showed up early in the morning at the registrar's office. And they were forced to stand there most of the day. The local sheriff, who was an absolute monster, Jim Clark, refused them from leaving the line to go to the bathroom or to get something to eat. And you know, every effort to secure the right to vote in Selma was beaten back. But Amelia Boynton, taking over after her husband died in 1963, in late 1964, invited Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. to launch a movement there on March 7th, 1965. Dr. King knew that George Wallace planned to block the march from Selma to Montgomery, and he was concerned that there would be violence. So on the morning of March 7th, he actually decided that the march should not occur. And he sent one of his top aides, Andrew Young, call the march off. By the time that Young arrived in Selma, he could already see this mass of Alabama state troopers and Clark's troops, which he called his posse, armed and waiting on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, where the marchers would cross. The marchers, 600 strong, were ready to go. It was impossible to turn them back. Young called Dr. King, explained the situation, and King said, "Well, if you think that they're only going to be arrested." And so that afternoon, after prayer, they marched to the bridge and were confronted by the state troopers and Clark's posse. Troopers on horseback with electric cattle prods. Amelia Boynton was beaten. Future Congressman John Lewis was struck in the head. Someone called for an ambulance, and Sheriff Clark said, "Let the buzzards eat them." Also present that day were photojournalists, and they got the attack of marchers being beaten and tear gassed. They got it on film. Film was rushed to New York. ABC broke the news first. Americans watching the footage and then seeing photographs in the following morning's paper were just stunned. They could not believe that this kind of thing could happen in America. Peaceful marchers being assaulted by this army of troops. People rushed to Selma to join King's movement. They marched on Washington, calling for a voting rights bill, besieged Lyndon Johnson in the White House. Johnson was sympathetic to a voting rights bill, but the 1964 Act had been passed only the previous July, and he didn't think the Congress and the country was ready for another civil rights bill. But Bloody Sunday, as it came to be called, changed everything. Johnson was able to put that bill at the top of his legislative agenda, and he gave a historic speech in which he said that the hero of this story was the American Negro. Their courage had awakened the conscience of the nation. On March 17th, the bill was introduced in the Congress, and it had some difficult going and was not finally signed into law until August 6th, 1965.
What were the key components of the Voting Rights Act that really sort of changed the landscape for voters, for particularly African Americans?
Well, it was first of all a bill to enforce the 15th Amendment, which made it illegal to prevent people from voting on the basis of race, color, and condition of previous servitude. It had a number of provisions. The most controversial one was Section 5. Section 5 required those states which were covered by the Voting Rights Act. These were states that had the worst voting records in terms of African Americans voting, based on a formula of voting in the 1964 presidential election. Those states which were covered, and they were mostly in the South, they were required to submit any changes in voting practices to the Justice Department or a Washington, D.C. federal court, and to receive the permission, it was called preclearance, before they could make any change. This proved to be a extraordinarily effective part of the Voting Rights Act because it acted as a deterrent from Southern states making changes that were injurious to African-American voting. Even when they went ahead and did it anyway, the Justice Department would strike it down. The Supreme Court in June of 2013 actually struck down Section 4, the formula that allowed Section 5 to go into effect. So the act was really gutted. It was severely weakened by the conservative majority. There are other provisions of the Voting Rights Act which allows the Justice Department and other interested parties to launch lawsuits, but it's not as good as when Section 5 could work. It now requires a much longer, more difficult legal process. What happened in 2010, the Republicans swept the country. Many, many governors and state legislatures became completely Republican. And it's at that point that you begin to have in so many of these states these efforts to require a voter ID, cutting back on the days when you could vote, and that we're going to continue to have these kinds of efforts to suppress the vote, and they'll have to be fought day by day, place by place in the courts.
That was Professor Gary May, author of Bending Toward Justice, The Voting Rights Act and the Transformation of American Democracy. And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. To find out more, visit our website at radioproject.org. That's also where you can download past shows and make a difference by supporting our work. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. I'm Laura Flynn. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.